Studio 360 is supported by Sacred Heart University, with a graduate school in film and television. This one-year master's program is devoted to cinematic storytelling and hands-on production. Applications are being accepted for fall. Information at ftma.sacredheart.edu.
Today in Studio 360, we come to grips with our fears, live on stage.
We're all going to die! My God!
Comedian Hari Kondabolu's got a BA in politics, a master's degree in human rights, and very little hope for our future.
We're screwed because corporations are treating the planet like we're in second semester senior year.
Plus, Jennifer Egan's got a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award, and she owes her writing career to a panic attack.
I mean, they couldn't solve the terror, but somehow narrating it made it feel like I was somehow ultimately in control of it rather than the other way around.
Plus, a live performance from Andrew Bird and the Hands of Glory. That and much more is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout, working to protect people and organizations from mobile threats with 50 million users worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
Hello. Thank you. Hello. And welcome to the Harvey Theater at the Brooklyn Academy of Music for a live edition of Studio 360. We are incredibly happy to be here as part of the week-long Radio Love Fest. And it really, since we do our show in a soundproof room, it is always exciting to be in front of living, breathing human beings. Almost 1,000 of you. Damn, there are a lot of them. Is my mic working? Can they hear me? We've done the show for live audiences in Los Angeles, in Seattle, in New York, all over the country, really. But never at a place I could just walk to from my house in Brooklyn.
Do I sound like I'm bragging?
And to do it here, in this amazing theater with smoke machines and the history that it has, for people like you who like what we do so much that you paid to see a program that you could have listened to for free in a couple of weeks.
I wonder if BAM is going to be mad at me for this.
In fact, you've paid $20 or $30 or $40 a piece.
Too late now.
To sit here for an hour and a half when you could be at home with Netflix or having a drink. I am honored, and I thank you. I want to start with a story, a few stories, actually. Back on June 6, 1944... someone I loved, my father-in-law, John Kramer, was preparing to die. He was a 21-year-old Army lieutenant about to lead his platoon into Normandy in the invasion of France. Was he scared? He never said so. If he was, he had that stoic Greatest Generation thing. And a week later, he took a shot in the head from a German gun. And he lived. But tonight, exactly 70 years to the day later, I'm afraid up here. Is a joke gonna fall flat? Is my microphone gonna go all weird and crackly?
Do these pants make my ass look enormous?
Those nagging voices in the back of your head that can really cripple you, or sometimes, if you're lucky, inspire great work. Today, we're going to talk about all kinds of fears. The rational worries, the irrational phobias, the things you should be scared of, and the things that aren't worth being scared of. Artists use fear in all kinds of ways, not just for motivation, but in their work. It's not just horror stories and thrillers that obviously have fear, but any story or any song needs a bit of tension, a hint of anxiety to
keep us on tenterhooks as we're listening or reading or watching. And here to help us explore all kinds of fears are two of my favorite Studio 360 guests and one of my newest favorite guests.
If I can pronounce his name right, Hurry Kondabolu. Hurry Kondabolu.
I'll talk with a novelist of originality and heft and the Pulitzer Prize to prove it, who also knows how to write an amazing page-turner.
Hurry Kondabolu.
Jennifer Egan. And really one of today's greatest singer-songwriters, a man whose work I've enjoyed paid to see.
Hurry Kondabolu.
Andrew Bird. And in his Studio 360 debut, a man you've probably seen on all kinds of television shows, one of comedy's great rising stars.
Oh, Christ, don't blow this.
Ladies and gentlemen, Hurry Kondabolu!
Yes, nailed it.
But right now, I want you to welcome to the stage the great Andrew Bird and the Hands of Glory.
On the way to Greenland, I shall find. Place where souls go to dry out. It is a vast and terrifying place of ice fields and tundra, bereft of fire, and in the horror of its imposing irrelevance, there's a kind of peace. The peace of pain, the peace of nothing. You know what, friends? I am going to Greenland.
Bird and the Hands of Glory.
That was Dear Old Greenland. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we are here live on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Please stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Sacred Heart University, with a graduate school in film and television. This one-year master's program is devoted to cinematic storytelling and hands-on production. Applications are being accepted for fall. Information at ftma.sacredheart.edu.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we are here live on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And with us tonight is our great house band. Okay, one guy on a piano. Joel Escher, ladies and gentlemen. My next guest studied politics at a prestigious liberal arts college. He got his master's degree in human rights from the London School of Economics. You'd think he'd be busy now running an NGO or giving TED Talks, but no, he gave up that career to tell jokes. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Hari Kondabolu.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Kurt, for that wonderful introduction. I am overqualified for this position. Before we begin tonight, I just want you all to know that the theme of my set will be colonialism. Right? Which is why I will be speaking only in English. So. This is very exciting for me to be able to perform with Andrew Bird and Jennifer Egan. It's very legitimizing, right? Because I'm a stand-up comedian, and stand-up comedy isn't always seen as a legitimate art form, and we're not seen as having legitimate professions. And I know this because people ask me what I do for a living, and I tell them I'm a stand-up comedian. And they say, oh, like not knowing how to digest that information. It's as if I said, I'm a scarecrow. Oh, you can do that for a living. Okay. I told that joke in Portland, Oregon, and I was worried I might offend somebody. Like somebody would get up and be like, excuse me, but I'm a scarecrow. Yes, that is sustainable here. Yes. We're paid mostly with beets and quinoa. I grew up in Queens, New York, which is one of the most diverse places in the world. I went to college in Maine, which is less so. Admissions told me, don't worry, there'll be a surge of diversity when you get to campus. I didn't know I was the surge they were talking about. Strange. But, you know, you spend 4 years in a place, you get close to people, and Maine's kind of become another home, right? So I'll go back every few years. And a few years ago, I'm in Portland, Maine, hanging out with a friend, and we're going to this Thai restaurant, and it's pouring rain out, right? Just pouring. And we're walking towards this restaurant, and I see this white dude walking towards us with his shirt off, which seems strange, you know, because it's pouring rain. Why does he have his shirt off, right? And as he got closer to us, I realized he had a swastika tattooed on his chest, right? And there was a part of me that believes in free speech that thought to myself, yeah, man, don't let the rain prevent you from expressing your political beliefs. But the minority part of me was like, run! You need to run now! Do not die in a cliched manner! Do not die in a cliched manner! White dude had a swastika tattooed on his chest, which just goes to show you how dysfunctional the white supremacist movement is. Really, white supremacists? You couldn't get an umbrella with a swastika on it? Etsy couldn't provide you with such an option? My friend, he's a little white dude, he starts apologizing. Dude, I'm so sorry. Dude, I'm so sorry. This isn't the time for your white guilt, Matt. There's a Nazi walking our way. We need to make some moves. Also, why are you apologizing? Do you know him? Did you tattoo him? Are we eating lunch with him? And the thing is, if we ate lunch together, I'm sure we'd find a way to make it work.
people find common ground despite their stark differences, you know? I mean, we'd avoid certain controversial topics like which race is the best, you know? I mean, we'd avoid that. Things I'm sure you all discuss with your friends and family. Maybe we talk about movies or something, you know? Hey, man, what's your favorite movie? Let me guess, American History X? I assume you only saw the first half? And who knows, maybe this Nazi likes Thai food. I don't know, your brain's not always the same thing as your palate, right? Maybe this Nazi likes Thai food. And if he does, I would love to read that Yelp review. The Tom Kha soup was very good. Had a coconut base. It's white. I like it. The Penang curry was also exceptional. I appreciated the spiciness. Unfortunately, they gave me seitan. I asked for tofu. He's vegan. I'm not saying all vegans are Nazis. I'm just saying this particular Nazi happens to be a vegan. Why? Because I'm giving him depth, right? Ironically, more depth than he would ever give me. The service was exceptional. Great hospitality. Unfortunately, I hate Asians. 0 stars, white power. So. He gave it a good try. They're pretty open-minded for a Nazi, you have to admit. The country's changing. White people are freaking out about it. I know they're freaking out because I keep hearing about the year 2042 on the news. For those of you who don't know, 2042, according to census figures, is the year when white people will be the minority in this country. They'll be 49%, and white people are freaking out. Don't freak out, white people. You were the minority when you came to this country. Things seem to have worked out for you. And here's the bigger point. Here's the more important point. 49% white doesn't make you the minority. That's not how math works. 49% white is only the minority if you think the other 51% is exactly the same. Well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. I mean, that's the only way that works, is that 51% is not a united front. And it's very easy to figure this out. Just ask a black guy and a Korean guy what happens when the black guy walks into the Korean guy's store, right? That interaction might not be pleasant. That interaction might not be like, hey, teammate. How's it going, teammate? Pretty excited, you? 2042, am I right? Probably not what's happening there. Might be some historic tension. It's strange. People are freaking out about demographic changes. And meanwhile, what we should be worried about is climate change, right? That's the change we should be freaking out about. We're all going to die. My God. Environment's going to hell. Why are we worried about all this other stuff? That's what we should be worried about. And we keep that, well, green capitalism, right? That's what we need. Green. No, maybe I'm cynical. I don't think capitalism is going to save us, okay? Maybe I'm cynical about it. I don't know. I was on a plane a few years ago. I was reading the in-flight magazine. The in-flight magazine on this particular plane trip was an environmental issue. How to save the planet. I was reading about how to save the planet while sitting on a pollution machine that can fly. Like the audacity of that, right? But I'm bored, so I'm reading along. And the first article I read is called Top 10 Endangered Places, right? And here's the first sentence. Climate change and tourism are threatening to destroy these natural wonders. So I'm amazed, right? Because tourism is clearly in the best interest of the airline industry, right? Way to take a stand, Delta, right? But then I read the rest of the sentence. Climate change and tourism are threatening to destroy these natural wonders. So you might want to plan a trip now before these sites are gone for good. We're screwed. We're screwed because corporations are treating the planet like we're in second semester senior year. It's almost over. F*** it. So weird. I just put out an album on the indie label Kill Rock Stars that I'm really excited about. And the album's called Waiting for 2042, and I think you all understand why now.
And the album cover is me on the back of a bicycle rickshaw being peddled by an old white dude in a business suit. It's like, it's amazing. It's amazing. Like, honestly, like, I want that etched on my gravestone, you know, because that's what's going to get me killed. It's amazing. And what inspired the idea was I was at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, right? And they had these pedicabs being driven by, like, these scrawny white dudes, right? The pedicabs, but, like, you know, they're basically bicycle rickshaws, right? And I couldn't believe it, all these bicycle rickshaws being pedaled by white dudes. So I got in the back of one, and the guy's like, so where do you want to go? And I'm like, I don't give a f***. I have $200. Take me as far as you can take me. My grandmother in India would not believe this. My grandson's made it! He's made it! This is some weird kind of colonial justice. White dude powered rickshaws. That's my preferred form of transport, honestly. I would take that all over the country. Hurry, you got a gig in San Francisco next week. It's gonna have to be next month. I'm going by rickshaw. White dude powered rickshaw. Only white power I believe in. Thank you very much, everybody.
The great Hurricane Bolu. His new album, as he mentioned, is Waiting for 2042. Why, your hair is great, Hurry.
Thank you. You know, some people have said that's my best quality. They don't usually like my stand-up.
As you told me, somebody famous just told you your hair was great last week.
I was, a couple days ago, I was at the vice president's house in Washington, D.C. for a Asian American Pacific Islander event. And I went, you know, which some people, I know some people are laughing.
Pacific,
like,
Island!
It's like, but I went to this event, and they had a, you know, afterwards you could take a picture with the vice president, Dr. Biden, and we lined up, and you know, I went up there, and he said to me, "If I had hair like yours, I'd be president right now." And
you said, "Nah."
Right. I'm like, I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to get droned. but now I will.
So 2042, the year you've talked about, that the Census Bureau says that white people will no longer be a majority in this country.
Yeah.
And I guess I'll be dead and you'll have some children. So that explains that,
right, I guess. Right.
So when that figure came out a few years ago, did you just say, whoa, comedy gold for me, I'm taking this and running?
I mean, I kept hearing it over and over again. And I'm like, why is this a big deal? Because the first time you hear the story in CNN or whatever, which is my mistake to you know, but like... you kind of are like, okay, this is a thing, I guess. I don't know why it's important. Because, I mean, I grew up in Queens, so it's like, white people have been the minority since I've been born. Like, it wasn't like... Well. And honestly, I didn't know any white people. Like, I did, but like, when they'd ask me where I was from, I'd say India, even though I grew up in Flushing or whatever. Yeah, I was born in Flushing. And I asked them where they'd from. They'd say, I'm Greek, or I'm Italian, I'm Irish. There are no white people. And that's right. So corny.
I'm white.
It was white. Yeah. This isn't the Midwest. Nobody's white here.
Well, and not just Queens. New York has been a minority of white people for years. So
right.
I guess we're the future.
It's not a bit right. You're the new ethnic cuisine. I'm excited about your pot roast.
Thank you.
I've heard
Thank
so
you.
Much about.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's like it's like an archaeological dig for food.
Right,
it's very
exactly.
exciting and
the mayo. but are white people, do you think, actually scared, or is that just a comedic trope?
No, I've you have heard of this Tea Party business, haven't you?
Well, but not all white people are Tea Party.
No, I mean, I didn't do the full joke for time and for comedic effect, but the rest of the joke is basically how race is a construct, and it's, you know, it's not like an actual real thing. There was a time in this country where Italians weren't white, and the Irish weren't white, and, you know, the Polish weren't white. I mean, it's not a real thing, and all white people aren't the same either. So the whole thing is a way to divide us, and it's not, you know, it's not something we actually should be worried about. So, I mean, this hysteria that's being created in the media, but 2042, it's like, it's absurd, because I don't think it's that big a deal. And also speaks to our other racial history. Like, if you're white and you have a kid with a person of color, that person can't be white. You know, it's part of our history too. So it's an absurd thing. So I don't, you know, there'll be people that are going to be kind of like, why do we have to have this menu in Spanish too? You know, but it's like, those people will die soon, no? No offense to your grandparents.
Well, offense to some of your grandparents.
Right,
probably.
Maybe.
When you started doing comedy as a high school kid in
Townsend Harris High School.
Yeah. So were you talking about race and politics and class and demography then, or just doing stoner jokes?
No. I did mostly it was Chris Rock and Margaret Cho bits that were stolen with the word Indian in it. And impressions of my parents, because those are easy laughs. And at a certain point, you develop your own, you know, point of view, and you get a bit of a backbone, and you're like, this is easy, and kind of exploitative, and, you know, I change. Also, 9/11, you know, kind of had an effect on everybody, and so, you know, when I see, like, hate crimes in Queens, where I'm like, shocked, but we all grew up together, why are people getting hurt because they're brown, and, like, you know, I became a very different person. I'm like, why am I going on stage doing impressions of my father when real stuff's happening? So I was a really different comic at that point, and some would argue, less funny.
And you went from being teen comic to being serious guy who's going to save the world and get his degrees and go do that. What made you decide to start telling jokes about injustice rather than solving it?
I mean, why did you decide to waste your education, Hari? Dad. After 9/11, being exposed to so much more, I was actually becoming a politicized being. Like, I started listening to comedy that, like, it was impacting me. Like, I remember David Cross released a double disc right after 9/11 called "Shut Up, You Baby," and it was incredible. And it's funny because The Daily Show did all this stuff about, like, Cheney and Rumsfeld for years, but really when that double disc came out, like, I think Cross was one of the first that really dug into it and really went all in. And, like, that record to me was like, whoa, you can talk about this and basically in real time, you know? And that was incredible. And I saw Paul Mooney do stand-up in Washington, D.C., and Paul Mooney wrote for Pryor, he wrote for In Living Color, you know, he was, you know, worked with Chappelle. Like, he's this legend, and he talks about race so bluntly, and he's so political, and he allows himself to be angry on stage, and he'll let people walk if they're going to walk, as it's his uncompromising voice. And the idea that you can make people uncomfortable and still be funny and say your truth, it's like, that is a more interesting journey than, like, my dad sounds like this, my mom sounds like this. Whoa, they sound the same. I'm not good at impressions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And you told me backstage, which I guess didn't surprise me, but because you do stuff about race a lot, you have been known to get hate mail.
Yeah, you know, because I've been appearing on NPR a lot more.
And they're haters.
I get every time I'm on NPR, I get something. And I was on All Things Considered Weekend Edition with Arun Roth, and I got this one after that appearance because I talked about my album cover. And this guy said, just got through listening to an interview on 90.5 about your album 2042 and was very offended by your comments. It seems we have some reverse racial discrimination going on. Which, that doesn't mean anything to me. When I read that, I'm like, sir, I believe in magic and think you should believe in magic as well. It's not like a real thing. All right. What is that, reverse racial discrimination? Don't forget, once the Obama dollar becomes even more devalued, no one will be the winner, and you will not be able to grin and say, I've made it. I didn't know, you know, the president was even on a bill. By the way, I listen to your music, and you are a disgusting, no-talent little Now, to be fair, Kurt, if he did listen to my album thinking it was music...
Yeah.
He has every right to be disappointed by it.
It's a spoken word, rap-ish kind of thing.
Well, my punchlines don't hit. They are slam poetry, to be fairly honest.
Now, one of our big theme today is fear. To me, other than a job where you might actually get killed, being a stand-up comedian, about the scariest thing I could imagine.
Yeah, comparable to people in the armed forces or...
Or Justin Bieber.
I mean, it's... I mean, there is a certain... it's a very bizarre thing that I need to do this and that the love of my friends and family isn't enough, you know.
But is it actually... Is it terrifying when it's not a wonderful room like this and people aren't laughing?
No, it's scary, and there is a part of me, too. Like, this was such a fun show, and people were loving what I was doing. And yet, at the same time, I saw a human yawn. And...
There are 1,000 people here. I saw a single human yawn, and that ate me up midway through the set. Like, they can all go to hell. It's like one person yawned. There was a only one person yawned. Yawned. Kurt, and I'm still not over it. Why are you trying to hurt me?
You're a very sad person.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I'm a stand-up comedian, yes.
You do a podcast with your brother, a show,
yes,
who I heard of before I heard of you, because he was in the hip-hop act Das Racist.
Yes, my brother was Dapwell, the hype man, or as he calls himself, the glorified backup dancer.
More humor about race, really.
Right.
Do you have a good relationship with him?
Oh, my brother and I are very close.
Are you mean to him, being the older brother?
Yeah, no. He could always beat me up. No, I mean, we're very close. We're like, you know. I'm trying. The only reference I have is like a Hindu epic reference. We're like Rama and Lakshman, which three of you took that class in school or are Indian or Hindu. So, but yeah, you know, we're linked. So we're always together. And like our podcast, the Untitled Conde Boldo Brothers podcast, is amazing, though terrible production quality. But we're good enough where people will still listen despite, vibrations and echoes. And, we don't really know what we're doing.
Yeah, well, that music you do on it, it just doesn't. It's not my cup of tea.
Right.
Are your parents just overjoyed to have a rapper and a comedian as their sons? Or?
When they left everything behind to come to this country, this certainly was the plan. Yes, absolutely. I remember my father just working 7 days a week, sending me to Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, and telling me, waste this. This is not for you to use in anything. If you come back here a doctor or a lawyer, it's like killing me. Don't make sure you do nothing of real value.
So that South Asian stereotype parent just isn't true.
No. They're groundbreakers. They are, though. They're pretty amazing.
Is there any issue that makes you queasy? Like, I can't do that. I can't go here.
I mean, I think it's all context. You know, I think any topic is potentially something you can talk about, but it's how you do it, right? And it's also the relationship and the rapport you build with an audience. And certainly, like, I've talked about things where I'm like, maybe I'm not, you know, I know that recently I've tried to talk more about, like, transgendered issues, and I feel like sometimes I don't have the knowledge to do it properly, and so I usually go to Seattle when I'm working on new material. Like, I'll rent out a 40 seat theater, and that's where I started in Seattle.
Not just because Seattle is a great comedy epicenter,
and also it's far enough away where nobody will find out if things didn't go well. But I'll go to Seattle, I'll work on stuff, and I did a lot of this material about transgender issues, and it was painful. I felt so uncomfortable by, like, I'm just worried that I'm going to say the wrong thing, and I don't want to hurt. Offense is fine. I'm fine with offending people, but, like, hurting people is never my goal, and I feel like I want to say something meaningful and thoughtful, and at the same time, if I don't actually have the right words or the right ideas, and if I'm pressing the wrong buttons, I don't know. Like, I want to kick upward. So I feel like everything is on the table, but it's how you talk about it, and that's me, and that's a lot of my heroes did the same thing. So.
Do you have, if we saw you for an hour, as I'm sure we all will now that we've seen you for a few minutes, do you have any just funny, stupid, non-socially conscious jokes that you?
I love going after Weezer, and if there's an opportunity to.
You're of the Weezer generation. I think of you as the Weezer generation.
I'm the first wave Weezer generation. I mean, it really goes downhill
before
after
they changed.
Yeah, from the Green Album on, really.
Yeah.
And it's not connected to 9/11. I've thought about this. It was released May of 2011, so it was months before. I don't know what Weezer's involvement was, but whatever. But
you were a Weezer truther, aren't you?
That's weird. Everything went downhill after third record came out. I was a huge Weezer fan growing up. It's actually weird because I put a joke out on my album called Weezer Broke My Heart. And it's just about like how Weezer just completely just went to hell. And it's horrendous. I'm just bashed them the whole way through. And then Rivers Cuomo, the lead singer of Weezer, started following me on Twitter. And then, I like sent him a direct message, and I was like, hey, Rivers. And he's like, hello. And I'm assuming you've heard the joke. Nope, haven't heard it yet. I'm like, why are you screwing with me? You're messing with my head, Cuomo. But I don't know if he's heard it or not, but I don't know. They were having a weird thing on Twitter. I don't know. Maybe after this comes up, maybe we'll be best friends. I want to be best friends with him. I'm still 14 in my heart. Like, I still... Matt Sharp, the original bassist, will rejoin the group. Everything will go back to normal, and, you know, we'll go back to 2000 when things were safer.
Yeah. Hurry, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Kurt.
Ladies and gentlemen, Hurry Kondabolu. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. We are on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Coming up, I'll talk with Jennifer Egan. We'll hear some of her fiction. This is Studio 360. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and organizations from mobile threats worldwide. More information at Lookout.com.
This is Studio 360. We are on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music talking about, among other things, what scares us. Jennifer Egan had sent just really a handful of tweets ever when she decided to do something pretty bold, if not scary, to publish a story on Twitter. People had tweeted fiction before, but not anybody who had just won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. What if it bombed? It didn't bomb. It killed. The story is called Black Box. It's a sci-fi thriller. And ladies and gentlemen, here's Jennifer Egan to read some of it for you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Black Box. People rarely look the way you expect them to, even when you've seen pictures. The first 30 seconds in a person's presence are the most important. If you're having trouble perceiving and projecting, focus on projecting. Necessary ingredients for a successful projection: giggles, bare legs, shyness. The goal is to be both irresistible and invisible. When you succeed, a certain sharpness will go out of his eyes. Some powerful men actually call their beauties beauty. Counter to reputation, there is a deep camaraderie among beauties. If your designated mate is widely feared, the beauties at the house party where you've gone undercover to meet him will be especially kind. Kindness feels good, even when it's based on a false notion of your identity and purpose. Posing as a beauty means not reading what you would like to read on a rocky shore in the south of France. Sunlight on bare skin can be as nourishing as food. Even a powerful man will be briefly self-conscious when he first disrobes to his bathing suit. It is technically impossible for a man to look better in a Speedo than in swim trunks. If you love someone with dark skin, white skin looks drained of something vital. When you know that a person is violent and ruthless, you will see that violent ruthlessness in such basic things as his swim stroke. What are you doing from your designated mate amid choppy waves after he has followed you into the sea may or may not betray suspicion. Your reply, swimming, may or may not be perceived as sarcasm. Shall we swim together toward those rocks may or may not be a question. All that way, if spoken correctly, should sound ingenuous. We'll have privacy there. May sound unexpectedly ominous. 100 feet of blue-black Mediterranean will allow you ample time to deliver a strong self-lecture. At such moments, it may be useful to explicitly recall your training. You will be infiltrating the lives of criminals, you will be in constant danger. Some of you will not survive, but those who do will be heroes. A few of you will save lives and even change the course of history. We ask of you an impossible combination of traits: ironclad scruples and a willingness to violate them, an abiding love for your country and a willingness to consort with individuals who are working actively to destroy it, the instincts and intuition of experts, and the blank records and true freshness of ingenues. You will each perform this service only once, after which you will return to your lives. We cannot promise that your lives will be exactly the same when you go back to them. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan reading the beginning of her story, Black Box, published by The New Yorker magazine. So did the idea of publishing a story on Twitter happen first, or did that idea for a story happen first?
The idea of publishing a story or writing it for Twitter happened first. And as you say, it was strange because I had been a pretty unsuccessful tweeter. I had felt very self-conscious when I tried to tweet, and then someone infiltrated my account and spewed out a lot of vitamin advertisements. So that was basically the extent of
really,
my tweeting.
I bought those vitamins on your account. Right. So once you had, I'm going to do this on Twitter, the idea of a spy novel thing...
I think it was really just, I wondered, okay, what kind of story could live in this form? And I was particularly interested in the serialization and the sort of real-time emergence of one short iteration after another. And it took a while to hear a voice that could live in that kind of space. And really the key to it was the idea that the voice never really addresses the reader directly and never really describes action. The voice only reflects on what she's learned from each thing that happens. And that actually arose out of a list I was keeping on my iPhone of lessons I had learned from things I'd done wrong. Like, don't buy a Christmas tree that's too wide because it blocked all the light from the window that it was in front of. And I thought, well, if you just say don't buy a Christmas tree that's too wide, we can sort of infer what the problem might have been. And so it becomes this kind of interesting way to tell a story through the reflection of the action rather than the action itself.
It's so interesting. The way that this isn't the first time you've used technology to become a thing in your fiction writing obstacle course. You had this great, amazing chapter in Goon Squad that was a PowerPoint presentation. Is that what it's like? Is you have this notion of, a PowerPoint presentation. How can I make that successful in a work of art?
Yes, and often I have very little experience with the technology. So, for example, with PowerPoint, I had never actually used it at all when I had the idea. But it takes a while. I mean, if I could just graft any form onto any story, it would be easy. But in fact, it really has to be a story that couldn't be told any other way. And that is something that I often just have to wait for. I'll hear a certain voice, a kind of tone that I think maybe could live in this sort of odd structure.
You've talked about writing fiction, speaking of spy stories, as living a double life, almost like a spy. Talk about that. What do you mean?
Well, I just mean that I'm living a fairly conventional life in my real life, but I feel like I have this alternate world that I'm visiting all the time. I mean, I think it's why people play video games or like to live in virtual reality worlds. I can really understand that because in a way I feel like I'm doing that all the time. And I don't know what it would be like not to have that other world to go to or to sort of to have that the kind of synchronicity between the two. It's something I really thrive on.
So instead of having to have affairs and secret spy lives, you just go into your make-believe room.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one reason that I never write about my own life, you know, because for me that would really defeat
the purpose. You weren't kept in a crazy castle and you didn't do all these things? No? Those aren't real?
I'm so sorry to disappoint you. But yeah, I think for me, the idea that it's the feeling of being lifted out of my life into another world that is the thrill of writing fiction. When I have to write about myself, I feel really bored and stymied.
And talking about if a Christmas tree blocks the light, probably would be boring, frankly,
exactly.
In a work of fiction. You've talked also about how panic attacks shaped you as a writer. How so?
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty panicky person. I think I've gotten a little better as I've gotten older, but I had a pretty... I had never heard of a panic attack. That term, I think, had not yet been coined when I really experienced this, which was when I was 18. I had a backpack and went to Europe, bought a Eurail pass, and just traveled around by train. And I began to have these, you know, bouts of terror. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I really thought I was losing my mind. And it was, as you can imagine, awful. And I would dread the arrival of this state. I never knew when it would come, and I would sort of think it was going to happen, but then it didn't. And then when it did, there was no mistaking it. And then I would think, well, that will never happen again. So it was awful, and then it would happen. But what came out of it, interestingly, was the choice to be a writer, because what I found was that it was writing that seemed to not only anchor me, I mean, it couldn't solve the terror, but somehow narrating it made it feel like I was somehow ultimately in control of it rather than the other way around. So I came back from that trip, which was the end of a year off between high school and college, determined to be a writer.
And did the panic attacks stop?
They did. I mean, traveling alone in Europe was probably a fairly extreme state for a panicky 18-year-old to be in.
Yeah.
I think, too, you know, it was a kind of isolation that we absolutely do not have anymore. I mean, this was obviously, you know, this was...
Because of devices,
1981.
You mean?
Yeah. Because of devices. I mean, I grew up in San Francisco, so if I was in Europe, it was a 9-hour time difference, and I would wait in line at a international calling place, and maybe someone would answer the phone, or maybe I'd get a busy signal after all that. So I felt really cut off, and so when I came back to college, it just felt like the most comfortable, you know, cloistered place in the world. It was great.
When we talked last after Goon Squad had come out, you said you were working on a new novel set in the 1940s. Is that still the work in progress?
Yes, it is.
How's it going?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask. No, it's a pretty fascinating experience, actually. I'm reminded of a few things. One is that it's just so hard to really write a decent book. I mean, it's just so tough. You know, even if maybe you think you came close to doing it once or twice, it doesn't really help. It's interesting. I feel that I've done stuff that some people think is daring, like writing in Twitter or PowerPoint. But to me, I guess maybe that had become almost a path of least resistance, because what I'm finding is that I can't seem to make any bell or whistle really work in this new book. It just has to be kind of a straight storytelling.
Telegram from Winston Churchill.
And that
don't
is
do
terrifying.
It. Yeah. And does the fact that A Visit from the Goon Squad was so successful in every respect add to the sort of fear?
I'm sure it does, although I always feel very afraid as I work on books, or at least for part of the time. I feel a huge pressure every time. I can't say that it's worse. I had forgotten how bad it is to feel that pressure and to worry that, you know, you can't make the book good. I mean, it's really, it's a, like any job, it has its stressful moments.
And is the fear predictable in the course of writing a book? I mean, at the beginning when the mountain still seems so high, or does it come later when, like, oh, this is crap? Or when does it happen?
I think it depends on the book, actually. It's been different every time. This one, I would say, I've learned another thing, which is that while I don't use my own life, as I said before, I'm very reliant on my own memory of times and places, so I feel very cut off from that, being outside of my lifetime. And that is actually very scary to me. I feel sort of unmoored. And so it's a huge challenge. I'm not quite sure I can pull it off, but then I think, well, if, you know, if I'm doing something I know I can pull off, that's not the book I should be writing.
Absolutely right. I can't wait to read it, and I'm sure your millions of fans can't either. Jennifer Egan, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan is the author of The Keep, A Visit from the Goon Squad, and other novels. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a gigantic hand to Jenny Egan, Hari Kondabolu, Andrew Bird, and Tift Merritt. And thank you all from the bottom of our hearts for coming to Studio 360 live at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, our debut. I hope you had a good time. There was much more in our live show at BAM than could fit in an hour, including more songs from Andrew Bird and the Hands of Glory. So you'll hear those on the show in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, we've got a surprise for you online. It's a kind of radio drama starring Hari Kondabolu as General Curtis LeMay, Andrew Bird as the theme from Psycho, and Jenny Egan as my wife. Intrigued? Check it out at studio360.org. And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Jill Dubois,
Sophia Witt,
Ariel Roland Wang,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
Special thanks to Ed Haber, George Wellington, and Rick Kwan for recording this week's show. A tremendous thank you to Audrey Hu, Nick Schwartz-Hall, and the amazing team at BAM. And thanks, just regular, although undying thanks, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we revisit the first animated character and the first time Tarzan swung through the jungle and the first mass market blues song.
Ever since Miss Susan Johnson lost her jockey lead.
It's a 1914 time capsule next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You can hear